Oh, so I'm not taking any of her time, which is your time, so I give you Dr. Rosen's.
Thank you so much. It's really always a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. And I want to speak today about Megillat Esther because it's Rosh Chodesh, or it's Adar. So we're really going to try to analyze Megillat Esther. And we're trying to see what the message of Megillat Esther is, and also what do we see in the literary text that really highlights certain earlier themes in Tanakh and are reflected in Megillat Esther. And we want to see that in the Pshat, and we're also going to see that, at least for this shiur, we're going to focus on some of the Midrashim and a few Mefarshim, really to see how we see this kind of integration. Now, we're already in the period of Arba Parshiot, right? We just read Parshat Shkalim, and we're coming to Parshat Zachor, which is going to be the next one in the Arba Parshiot. And what we see in the Arba Parshiot is that the Maftir, right, will always connect with the Haftarah. And what we see with our Haftarah of Parshat Zachor is that the Haftarah of Parshat Zachor is Shaul's attempt at Mechiyat Amalek. Shabbat Zachor always comes before Kriyat HaMegillah, which means when Chazal instituted Kriyat HaMegillah and instituted, the idea of Arba Parshiot, right, and the idea of Haftarah, what we see is that the Megillah always has to be read in light of Mechiyat Amalek by Shaul, and of course Mechiyat Amalek by Moshe and Yoshua, and the Zecher, right, in Sefer Dvarim, of Zachor Asher Asal Lecha Amalek. So what does that mean? That means that when you read the Megillah, right, according to what we see, the Hashkafa of Chazal is that you already have before, because Shabbat Zachor always comes before the Megillah, right? You have already in your mind Mechiyat Amalek in the Torah and Mechiyat Amalek in Nevi'im. And by the time you get to the Megillah, you are already reading Megillat Esther with these Sfarim in mind. And what we're going to see, it's not just that you have these Sfarim in mind, we're going to see the language of the Megillah already reflects back to these issues in Torah and in Navi. And that's what we're going to try to see today. So what's the message of Megillat Esther? And how do we see Megillat Esther reflecting back on the earlier places in Tanakh? When we start, we're in Esther Perek Bet, we're on number one, right? We're only going to do a certain piece, right? If we did all Megillat Esther, we'd be doing this for a month, right? But in the Shi'ur that we are going to be focusing on today, we're going to be focusing on Mordechai and Esther, Haman and Achashverosh, and then a look back at other issues and personalities, especially in Tanakh, that really reflect on our Megillah. So we're starting. Ish Yudi haya b'Shushan HaBira, u'shmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shim'i ben Kish Ishimini. When Mordechai is already introduced to us, what we see very interestingly is that he has a double identity. On the one hand, he's Yehudi. On the one hand, he's Yemini. Now, we know from a genealogical point of view, he really is from Shevet Binyamin, right? And what kind of families does he come from, right? Who are some of the people in his lineage? We have Shim'i, which we usually identify as Shim'i ben Gera, and Kish. And who is Kish? The father of Shaul HaMelech, Shaul ben Kish. Now, what is so interesting, because who do you think is the big hero or the most known personality of Shevet Binyamin, right, that should be identified? Shaul HaMelech. So the fact that Shaul HaMelech is not mentioned in the identity of Mordechai Yudi is already telling us that almost Shaul is written out of history. It's almost like in those books where someone's name fades out, right, as he is being lost from the narrative. What happens with Shaul is because he does not destroy Amalek completely, when he has the chance as a melech to destroy Amalek, something happens to his lineage. Something happens to his name. It's a stain on his name. So when we discuss Mordechai Yudi, right, Shaul HaMelech's name is not mentioned. What we're going to see part of Megillat Esther is to redeem the family name, is to bring Shaul ben Kish back into the picture, is to already redeem the actions of Shaul ben Kish. Also, what's interesting here is the idea that he's called Yehudi. Now, we know practically why is he called Yehudi? Because all the Jews, right, who went into Galut, most of them are from what Shevet? From Yehuda. So all the Jews, just like we're all called Jews, just like later on in history, earlier on, meaning after Mordechai's time, but later on in history, constantly, the Jews were called Yehudim, Judea, right? Even though there were some other individuals involved. So you could say it's also just Yehudi, he's a Jew, right? Or it's also telling us something very interesting. There's something about Mordechai that also reminds us about Yehuda and Shevet Yehuda. And what we're going to see with Mordechai is that Mordechai, in a sense, and the Midrash says that maybe his mother was from Shevet Yehuda, and that's where he has this identity. But something about Mordechai is also very straightforward. Step up. Really, what do we see about Yehuda generally in Tanakh? They step up. Vayigash elav Yehuda, right? Vayigash David elav Plishti, which means they are forward. They always, you know, step up. They have a certain leadership quality, right? That they solve problems, you know, head on. So we're going to see this interesting dichotomy and dynamic that we have with Mordechai Hayudi. So on one hand, Yehudi, but on the other hand, he's Yemini, and yet how is he always identified in Megillat Esther? Mordechai Hayudi. So even though we know his lineage, right, he became the representative of all Am Yisrael. So what we're going to see also in the Megillah, very interestingly, that while Mordechai represents all of Am Yisrael, who is going to be the one who's going to be seen as the keeper of the flame of the Binyamin, Shaul, Kish line? It's going to be Esther HaMalkah. And that's what we're going to see in the Megillah as well. Now, the Gemara, number 2, Masechet Megillah, Daf Yud Bet Amud Bet. So this is an interesting Midrash. And the Midrash says, why is he called Yehudi and Yemini? And they give a whole bunch of reasons and ideas, and I just want to bring the last one that it really proposes. The Lokatle David L'Shim'i, right? David HaMelech did not kill Shimi ben Gera when? What did Shimi ben Gera do when David HaMelech was running away from Avshalom? He curses him, and he curses him klala nimretzet, a very extreme curse. Why? Shimi ben Gera is from the Shaul HaMelech family, right? He sees that David is exile, and he says, you deserve this, right? So David does not kill Shimi ben Gera, even though Shimi ben Gera is mekalel HaMelech. He could be a mored b'malchut, and he really deserves onesh mavet. But David HaMelech doesn't kill him. But as a result of David HaMelech not killing Shimi ben Gera, what was he able to do? Reproduce? Have children? And eventually, the Gemara says, Mordechai was born. And what is Mordechai going to be? The avenue and the agent to destroy Haman. Which means, so in whose schut, really, is Mordechai alive? In the schut of David HaMelech. Which means that's why Mordechai, in a sense, is also identified with Yehudi. He's only here because David HaMelech, that's from Shevet Yehuda, really, you know, left Shimi ben Gera alone, and he was able to have children and continuity. But it also is telling us something else, which means the Gemara is telling us, when you read the Megillah, how do you have to read it? All earlier events in Tanakh have ramifications for Kriyat HaMegillah, for the Megillah, which means everything earlier in Tanakh, and constantly we see this idea of Midah Keneged Midah, Maseh Avot Siman Labanim, everything that happens earlier, measure for measure, has events later on. Everything has reverberations. Everything has echoes. And what was Mordechai able to do? Demikne Be Haman. And Mordechai was able to kill Haman. On the other hand, Umashilem Li Yemini, right? And what do we have as a legacy of Shevet Binyamin? The Lokat Le Shaul Agag. When Shaul had a chance to kill Agag in Milchemet Amalek, what doesn't he do? He doesn't kill Agag. He leaves Melech Amalek alive, right? So what is the legacy of David? Ironically, he gives us Mordechai. And what is the legacy of Shaul? By not killing Agag, who did he give us? Haman HaRasha, right? So again, what is the point here? Which means everything you do has ramifications, right? And we have to look back in order to look forward. And that's what the Gemara is telling us. So in everything, we're seeing that you can't just read the Megillah in a microcosm. You just can't read it separate from everything else, right? Kriyat HaMegillah, you always have to look back to a lot of the earlier Sfarim in Tanakh. So let's do that. So number 3, right? We're in, again, Perek Bet Pasuk Vav. Asher hogla miYerushalayim, ima gola, asher hoglata, im Yechaniah melech Yehuda. Why is it telling us about Galut? Why does the story of Megillat Esther tell us about Galut? Number 1, it is a Galut story. But number 2, one of the main themes we find in the Megillah, that the Jews not only are in Galut, but they are in a situation that they are losing their empowerment. They're losing their independence, right? They are dependent on the local power, which means they're not as unified. They're not as powerful. They're in galut. They're outside, literally, of their comfort zone. They're outside of a place of autonomy. So here is Mordechai, right, who represents Am Yisrael, but even he is in a diminished capacity because he's in galut. And galut always really equals powerlessness. On the other hand, we also have Hadassah. So not only is Mordechai in that situation, but he is Omen et Hadassah, he Esther. And again, what do we see with Hadassah and Esther? A double name. And what does a double name usually mean? Right? Dual identities. What really is her identity? What is she? Who does she mean? What are her goals? Right? What is her personality? So we don't really know. Right? So again, Megillah is all about being covered and uncovered. Hiddenness and things that are revealed, which means you have to understand the Megillah on a multiple range of levels, because everybody has two different agendas. There are so many different things going on. So it's also telling you, right, even though Hashem's name is not mentioned in the Megillah, right, whose, right, essence is really felt throughout the Megillah? It's Hashem's, but it's only if you look for it, which means what could you say about the world, right? We are running the world. Man is empowered. Man really runs the world, and there's no other game plan involved. On the other hand, how can you read Megillat Esther? Hashem's hand is in every, you know, line, practically, of the Megillah. So again, things you see, things you don't see. How do you have to read certain things in the Megillah? So he's Omen et Hadassah, she's Esther, and Ein La Avaim. So Bnei Israel are powerless because they're in Galut, but what is Esther? What do we usually say about the Ger Yatom and Almana? What do they need? Extra tzedakah, care, right? Because they're the defenseless society. They're the ones who are the least empowered in society. So here you have Mordechai, part of the Jewish people, that really are disenfranchised. And now you have Esther, right, who is totally disenfranchised. She's on the lowest rung. She does not have parents. And who takes her in? Mordechai, her uncle. So we see that Mordechai, at least within the family unit, is able to do what? Some kind of redemption, some kind of geulah, some kind of caring, some kind of undoing galut and bringing some kind of autonomy to Esther. And we have something else that's very interesting. How are we introduced to Esther? She's Yifat Toar, Yifat Mareh. Right away we know that she's beautiful. But what is fascinating in the entire Megillah? Whenever we speak about Esther and the way people perceive her, what does it always say about her? Batisachen b'chesed lefanav. Nos etchen, which means we never say, even Achashverosh when he sees her, it never says, oh, he likes her because she's beautiful, right? It doesn't say about anyone else who's connected with her that they like her or impressed with her because she's beautiful. It always talks about her chen v'chesed, which means there's something about Esther, right, that even though she is very beautiful in one sense, that's not what's special about her. That's not her main essence. And we have very interesting, again, because I want to read it, also within the look back of Tanakh, and also to see, right, how the Midrashim understand this connection with Tanakh as well. So the Gemara says something very, very interesting. The Gemara asks, so why give her a double name? What is the point of it, right? What does Esther tell us, and what does Hadassah tell us? So we see something very interesting. We're on number four, right? The Gemara in Megillah Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph says, why is she called Hadassah? Because the Tzadikim. Why are Tzadikim called Hadassim? From Chizayon of Zechariah. It says, and he's standing among the Hadassim. And how do all the Mefarshim explain the Hadassim? Who is he standing among? Tzadikim. So what's one view in the Midrash? What was Esther? Why is she called Hadassah? Because she is a tzadikah. She's a tzadeket. What's another view? Why is she called Esther? Al shem shaita masteret dvarea. She was hiding her words. What do we know about Esther constantly? What does it say? She's not saying. She's not identifying. Right? She's not saying who she is. Right? So she's hidden. That's why her name is Esther. What's another reason that her name is Hadassah? What do we know about the Hadass in the Arba Minim? It smells good, but what smells better? The etrog, right? And what about big? What's bigger than the Hadassim? What's taller than the Hadassim? The lulav. So what does Hadass mean? Average. Good, but average. Not bad, because what's worse than the Hadassim? Worse. Aravot, right? So Hadass means average. You're not a lulav. You don't smell as good, even because what do we like the Hadassim for? They smell really nicely. So, but the etrog smells better. So the Midrash is saying, so what does Hadassah represent? Esther represents being average. So what did we do? We went from being a tzedeket, right, to being hidden, unknowable, to being average. And what else does the Gemara say? What was her complexion really? Even though it says she's Yifat Torah v'Yifat Mereh, just like a Hadas. What color is the Hadas?
Green.
Green. What is her complexion?
Olive.
Green, olive. So what does that mean? So either you could say she's olive complexion and that's amazing, beautiful, or you could say olive green means she's green. Usually what do we associate when we call, right?
Sick.
Sick, right? Almost sickly, let's say. So again, this is so fascinating. So what is the Gemara saying? In a sense, she's really not beautiful at all, but chut shel chesed mashuch aleha. But she had a certain grace. She had a central elan. She had this inner peace. She just had something that radiated out from her that it didn't matter what her physical beauty was. Her inner beauty radiated out to such an extent that it made her unbelievable and special. So this is so interesting, which means, what would you expect? That all of the description should be in one theme. But we see here the extremes. Either she's a tzedeket, or she's average, or she's absolutely beautiful, or she's hidden, meaning what we see here, the Gemara wants to say she's unknowable. It's not important for us to understand or to know specifically what her specific traits were, because she's every woman, which means the Gemara wants to say by Esther being hidden, she represents every single one of us, which means she's the type of heroine that everyone can identify with because we don't know anything specific about her. Rav Rosenzweig says something very interesting about Avraham Avinu. What's the one thing it doesn't tell us in the Pshat about Avraham Avinu? How old he was when he converted, right? When he found Hashem? Right? And we don't know exactly what was the method. Either it's with the idols, or with the sun and the moon and the stars. We have so many different midrashim. Because what is Avraham to all of us? He's the symbol of the ultimate ma'amin b'Hashem and the ultimate ger. And what does that mean? Everyone has a different avenue of finding Hashem. And that's why Avraham for us is every man. Meaning everyone, I mean, and Avraham is such a high level, but everyone can aspire to that. There's not one way to find the Kaddish Baruch Hu. Same thing with Esther. There's not one way to be a great Jewish woman. There's not a way even to be a great Jewish woman who's going to do amazing things later on and be a great leader, right, and save all the Jewish people. And there's something in everybody that they have this ability to really bring Yeshua and Geulah la'olam. And that's why the Midrash is saying she's unknowable, right? It's not important even to know. And the range is very far, far-reaching. So that's one thing. Another thing that we see here, which is also very important to us, is the idea in the next part of the Midrash. So right now the Midrash is just saying, all we care about are her personal qualities. It doesn't matter who she comes from, what her background is. We only care about her. And about her, it doesn't matter because it's what she made of herself. It was her inner grace, how she developed. On the other hand, the Midrash says something very different. And that really works well with this. What's the other view the Midrash says? The Midrash says this. The Midrash says, "Bischat tzniut shaya ba berachel, zachta v'yatza mimena Shaul," which means because Rachel was so tznua, right? She had the zchut that Shaul became, you know, was one of her children, right? One of her progeny. "Ubischat tzniut shaya bo b'Shaul, zacha v'yatza mimenu Esther," which means what is a certain quality that really transferred and translated throughout all their generations? What quality? Tzniut, right? So on the one hand, we're saying she's unknowable, but on the other hand, we're saying what was one of her major traits that no matter who she was, that she was able to really use, right, and develop, and that was tzniut. And where does that come from? That comes from her lineage. So this is really what we're all about. On the one hand, right, we are our own people, and we have certain qualities that we really develop and that really we can make of ourselves. But on the other hand, all of us come from certain families. We have a certain kind of genetic makeup. We are who we are, right? It's very hard to totally transform yourself and make yourself completely something different. You have to work with what you have. And that's what this Midrash is saying. Esther comes from a certain line of people, and she identifies with that line, and she represents that line, and the way she acts will have to somehow work within that context, because that's real life. That's how life works. And also in Tanakh, we see that a lot, which means if you're from Shevet Yehudah, as we said earlier, right, what is a quality we see of many of Shevet Yehudah? They step forward. What else do we see about Shevet Yehudah? They fail in many situations, but, right before they're about to fail completely, what are they able to do? Right, tshuva, pull themselves up and really transform. So this is the message that the Midrash is giving us. And not, let's do number five. Let's go to the end. Right, va'amar Rabbi Elazar, k'shakodesh baruch hu posek gdula la'adam, posek levanav livnei banav ad sof kol adorot. What else did Esther have in her little bag of arsenals? Right, in her little bag of tricks? Right, she also had milucha, kingship. She comes from Shaul HaMelech, and even though Shaul HaMelech lost his melucha to David HaMelech, right, what still, right, is coursing through Esther's blood? Royalty. She still is royalty. She still is malchut, which means she can tap into that latent power every single moment. Which means whatever koach you have, even if you lost it for a while, you have that latent in you and you can always get it back. And that's what Esther can always get back. Somehow she has this kingship within her and she can always bring it out. She can always kind of materialize and realize that kind of power. She can always recapture that. Now when we meet Esther though, as the psukim tell us, what kind of personality is she? Look at number 6. Right, we're still in Perek Bet and we're in Pasukhet. What kind of personality is she? All the verbs that are written about Esther are what? She is always in the passive. She's the object. Vatilakach Esther. She is taken, right, when they have this contest. In Pasuk Tet, Vatitava na'ara be'ina vatisa chesed lifanav. Even when we say she has a lot of grace, even the way the Megillah is writing about her, she has grace in other people's eyes. Other people realize that. In Pasuk Yud, what does it say about her? What doesn't she say? Right? Lo higida Esther et amavet moladeta, ki Mordechai tziva alei asher lo tagid. So who's giving the commands all the time? Mordechai, and she is following. Also Pasuk Yud Aleph. Every day, why is Mordechai walking outside in the chatzer? Because he wants to see Shlom Esther uma Ye aseba, what will be done to her? So every single description of Esther for Perek after Perek after Perek until the middle of Perek Dalid is all in the passive. We don't know what she's thinking, what she knows, right? We don't know her personality. And again, that is the touchstone for the Midrash that we spoke before. On the other hand, what do we know about Mordechai, right? In the intervening prakim now, right, what does Mordechai do? Right, Haman is appointed a second in command, and what doesn't Mordechai do? He does not bow down to Haman. So what kind of act is that? Active. Aggressive, right? An act of protest, right? By not bowing down to Haman. And as we know, what does Haman want to do? Destroy Am Yisrael. And what does he want to destroy him? In what way? Look at number 7. We're in Perek Gimel. He has this idea, and he wants to destroy Am Yisrael. Now, this is also an interesting point that the Malbim and now David Gross, Yonatan Grossman make. And this is a very interesting point, which means when Haman is speaking to Ahasuerus, right, he says he wants le'abed et kol ha'yudim, and he also wants to get, right, tens of thousands of pounds of silver for Bnei Israel. So Ahasuerus is hearing the plan of Haman, le'abed et ha'yudim, and the question is, what does that mean? Does that mean kill them? That means lose them? That means sell them and get money for them? It might not be clear to Ahasuerus what Haman's plan is. But what is the writ? Meaning, what is the tzav? What is the letter that everyone gets? Very clear. Look in Pasuk Yud Gimel. Lehashmid, laharog, ule'abed. He doesn't say this to Ahasuerus, but when he writes this letter, it's very clear what he has in mind. Lehashmid, laharog, ule'abed, all the Jews. Nar adzaken, taf and ashim on one day, and what does he want to get in the end? Ushlalam, lavoz. He wants to get the kesef. He wants to get the money, which means it's very clear that Haman wants to destroy Bnei Israel. He wants to get the money. He tells Ahasuerus, destroy Am Yisrael, or maybe Ahasuerus thinks, sell them to Avadim. But what are you going to get in the end? Your treasury is going to be full. So we see money plays a very big role here. Materialism plays a big role here. How do we know materialism plays a very big role in Ahasuerus's court? How does the whole Megillah open? With parties, parties, and it describes in detail what everyone's wearing, what the building looks like, what dishes they're eating out of, drinking out of, right? So the materialism, the chitzoniyot, is very important, right, in Megillat Esther, right, in that description. So the question is, what are your values, similar to Purim, which means you wear costumes, you present in a certain way. What is that? Is that a face for the public, or is that really your inner essence and who you are? So also, Purim is a time that we can evaluate ourselves, play with different kind of costumes, different kind of identities, but we're really doing that for what? In order to really find our identity in the end. But what can many people do when it comes to the outward? You can sometimes get lost in it, right? And you don't think about the inner, and you just, the outside totally becomes who you are, instead of really internalizing it. So what we see about Haman, right? Money is very important when he destroys Am Yisrael, and his kavod was so important. Because why does he want to kill Mordechai and all the Jews? Because Mordechai didn't do what? Didn't bow down to him. Didn't show him kavod, right? He did not show him respect. So what's very interesting is what kind of lineage does Haman come from? He comes from Agag. And what is Agag? He was the king of Amalek. And we know that Amalek comes from Esav. Look at source number 8. In Breshit Lamedvav, right after Yaakov, right, meets up with Esav in Parshat Vayishlach, right, what happens? Yaakov meets Esav. Esav is sent presents, right? And Yaakov meets him. And Esav says, stay with me. Let's go together. And Yaakov says, oh, I have so many possessions. I have so many kids. I'm going to go so slow. I'm going to slow you down. We can't stay together. After they split, right? So the question is, what about Esav himself? Now, Esav has many different children, many different grandchildren. And look at this. Pasuk Zayin. We're in Perek Lamed Vav, number 8, Pasuk Zayin. Ki haya rechusham rav mishevet yachtav. Even the children of Esav, what couldn't they do? Sit together because of what? The rechush. Who else couldn't sit with Avraham because of the rechush? Lot. Right? And what does he say? Right? Originally, what were they doing and what couldn't they do? He says, Hiparedna me'alai. Right? Because they couldn't be together. Same language is used here. Right? Even the children of Esav could not stay together because of what? The rechush, which means materialism is splitting them up. Which means a value for Esav is the materialism. How do we identify Esav? Hakol kol Yaakov, but hayadai mide Esav. And what bracha did Esav receive? Al charbacha tichye, the sword, right? And also his bracha is very physical, right? How his land is going to be successful. So let's go on. Look at Pasuk Yud Bet. We're still in number 8. V'timna ita pilegesh le'elifaz ben Esav, v'teled le'elifaz et Amalek. So Amalek is a grandchild of Esav, which means Amalek is a representative of Esav. So the B'nai Yisrael Amalek conflict is really a Yaakov and Esav conflict, which means this is a conflict of ideologies that goes way back. This is not just some new thing that Amalek comes, Asher Korcha Baderech. This is something that really goes back, right, all the way to the beginning of time of Am Yisrael. Look at number 9. So, because of the attack of B'nai Yisrael and Amalek, what was the mitzvah that B'nai Yisrael had? To destroy Amalek. And what are the three laws, right, the three halachot that B'nai Yisrael have when they come into Eretz Yisrael? Well, let's do them in order. Appoint a king, destroy Amalek, and build a Beit HaMikdash. Excellent. So we have these three. So once you have Shaul, what do you have? The king. So what's his next main role? Michiat Amalek. So Shaul was required to destroy Amalek. And it's not like when he became Melech, what didn't he know? They know this was part of the thing, right? It's already in Shmot and Devarim that you have to do Michiat Amalek. So what do we see, right? Once you are appointed Melech al Yisrael, right? What do you have to do? Look at Pasuk Bet. We're number 9, Pasuk Bet, right? Koma Hashem Tzfakot, pakadeti et asher asa Amalek l'Yisrael, right? Because when they came up from Mitzrayim, asher kocha baderech. So what is their job? Pasuk Gimel. Ata lech vikitat Amalek, vecheramtem et kol asher lo. What's hecheramtem et kol asher lo? What's a cherem of the spoils? You can't touch the spoils. You have to destroy all the spoils, which means, what do we know is an important value for Amalek, for Esav? The rechush, the materialism. So when you destroy Amalek and you go against Amalek, if you take the money, if you take the booty and you take the spoils, what are you pretty much saying? I am like Amalek. This is not a war of ideology. I'm doing it for the money. Why are we upset? For many other reasons. But why do we see that Haman's real goal in destroying B'nai Israel is not just because he wants to destroy B'nai Israel. What does he want to get in the end? Ushlalam. Lavoz, he wants to get the money. Right? So when B'nai Israel go after Amalek, what's the one thing they cannot touch at all and have to destroy completely? The money. The biza, the spoils. Because if they don't, then the symbol is we did this to get the money. It'll be so clear it's not an ideological war. So he says, first thing, before anything else, he says, Echeramtem et kol asher lo. Your first goal is destroy all the material possessions. Then also, what do you do? The lo tachmol alav. You cannot have compassion. Because what would be the first thing that someone from B'nai Israel will have on another human being? compassion. We are rachmanim b'nei rachmanim, right? The default mode for a Jew, for b'nei Israel, is what? To have rachmanut. So what's the first thing Shmuel has to say to Shaul? V'lo tachmol. Don't be compassionate. Because what's our natural condition? To be compassionate. So Shmuel has to warn him. Because the next step, after you want to destroy all the material goods, which is not a problem, should not be a problem, but when it comes to destroying the people, what do you have to warn against? You have to hold your normal nature back. And what do you have to do? Listen to the language. What does that sound like? The edict of Haman. So what do we see later on? The edict of Haman is an exact mirror of what? What B'nai Israel were going to do to Amalek. So when Haman wants to destroy B'nai Israel, it's also payback time. Which means here was Shaul and this feud that B'nai Israel had with Amalek. Right? So what does Haman want to do? It's payback. Midah keneged midah. You wanted to kill us completely, now we're going to destroy you completely. In the same way. Right? And that was the tzivui. And what happens? Let's go to the next page. Page 2. Vayavo Shaul ad ir Amalek vayirev banachal. Shaul comes to the city of Amalek. He's about to, right, go on this war. And it says vayirev banachal. What is the pshat? And Rashi brings both. What does it mean, vayirev banachal? He fights. Right? In the Nachal, which means Amalek was next to a stream, right? And they fight next to the stream. Pshat. But what's the famous Midrash? We all know this famous Midrash. Great insight here. The Rabboteinu Amru, Chazal say, Al Iskei Nachal, Rav V'dan et Atzmo. What do we know happens next to a Nachal that's between two cities? Right? Uma bishvil nefesh achat. Right? Amra Torah, Erof Egla Banachal. Right? Bishvil kol anefashot aelu kol lo kol shekein im adah chata behema machata. And this is his question. He has a moral dilemma. How could Hashem command us to kill the women and the children and all the people? In halacha, we have this halacha that if you find a person murdered between two cities and you don't know who murdered this individual, right, then we have this kenim come and wash their hands over this dead body and we cut the neck of a young igla. And we do it next to a stream, and then we leave the stream bed fallow all this time. Why? Because how could it be in a moral and ethical society that our Yirei Hashem, that a body, someone will be killed, and no one cares, and no one knows, and we don't really have any moral and ethical obligation to this person? Absolutely. So even though the leaders, of course, did not kill this individual, what do they have to do? They have to wash their hands, right, over this dead body, which means it's a failure of leadership. So what is Shaul thinking? In our ethos and in our halacha, what do we have? We worry about what? One dead body in between two cities? All of a sudden, you're telling me I have to destroy women and children, an entire nation? Right? It doesn't seem moral and ethical. If Shaul really felt that this was a real dilemma, then what should he have done? What should he have done? Call Hashem. So let's say Shaul doesn't have a hotline to Hashem. What's the next best thing? Go to Shmuel, he has a Navi. So either he should tell Shmuel, ask Hashem, right? Or he should ask Shmuel, what's your psak, right? What does this mean? Or I need more clarification about this. But instead, what does he do? He decides, I will make the right decisions, right? I don't have to listen to Dvar Hashem. I know what to make the right moral and ethical decision here. And what does he do? Look at number 11, Pasuk Zayin. Vayach Shaul et Amalek. He does go and destroy Amalek. And not only that, vayitpos et agag melech Amalek chai. Who does he leave alive? The king. If you're doing this for moral and ethical reasons, who represents the nation? The king. Which means the king represents their ideology. By leaving the king alive, what is he saying? What?
Not denying the ideology.
Maybe he's agreeing with it. Also, he's only thinking of himself. Because maybe he's also thinking what? I'm a king. If there's a war with another nation, right, and they capture the king, what do I want them to be? I want them to leave me alone. I want them to be nice to me. Which means, even when Shaul is going against him, I'm like, what is he thinking about? Himself. He's not thinking about the bigger picture. Because look at the rest of the pasuk. Who does he kill? Vet kol ha'am hecherim lefi charev. He does go ahead and kill what? Everybody. Which means, he does destroy the people. And look what it says. Ha'am hecherim lefi charev. The word hecherim was used for what? The possessions, the material goods. So the fact that he's treating the people like material goods is already showing us what? right? A lack of focus and real values that are clear. Let's even go further on. Not only does it leave the king alive, and not only does it kill all the people, and including the women and children, what does it say in Pasuk Tet? Right? He has chemla, right, on Agag and the Tzon. What did the Pasuk say? We know it's so difficult to have compassion, right? So really, what should the compassion be for? The women and children, the people. But what did he have compassion for? Do you see how the words are working here? Which means he's having compassion for what? For Agag, the king who represents this evil, right? And on what? Metav Hatzon Vabakar. And what are Metav Hatzon Vabakar? Materialism. Not just plain materialism. Luxury items. The best. Which means, what is he saying? Right? All the cheap stuff he gets rid of, but he cares about the luxury items. Which means he leaves the materialism. He says, I'm doing it for Hashem, and I want to give this to Hashem. And what is the Navi going to tell him later? If Hashem told you to destroy it, you can't give from this Avera, right, to Hashem, right? It's unacceptable, because by not doing Dvar Hashem Bamalek, what are you pretty much saying? I don't listen to Hashem, and I decide what Hashem wants. That's not what Hashem wants. That's not Dvar Hashem. So what is, right, the response of Shmuel and Hashem? Hashem says, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Nichamti ki imlachti et Shaul lemelech, ki shav me'acharai, ve'et Dvarai lo hekim. He doesn't really establish and fulfill Dvar Hashem, which means, what's a very big theme in the whole issue of Amalek? What doesn't Shaul do? He doesn't fulfill Dvar Hashem. Now, what do you know later on in the Megillah is a very important theme that keeps on repeating itself in the Megillah. Ki imu v'kiblu, right? Uma amar ester kiyam et divrei hapurim ha'ele, which means, what's the point? Which means, Shaul is not fulfilling Dvar Hashem, right? But who is going to fulfill Dvar Hashem? Mordechai and Esther. And we're going to see, tit for tat, piece for piece, whatever is happening earlier in Tanakh, who's going to do a tikkun for it? Who's going to fix it up? Mordechai and Esther. And the way we're going to see it is not just in the general idea, but it's in the language itself as well. So what happens? Vayizak el Hashem kol alayla. Who cries out to Hashem all night? Shmuel. So whatever Shaul did causes Shmuel to cry out to Hashem all night. And Pasuk Yutet, to finish up with Shaul in this case, V'lama lo shamata b'kol Hashem v'ta'at el hashalal. What'd you go for? The booty, the money. Which means, what is the criticism of Shaul? That he went for the money. He's not being ideological. He's not going for Dvar Hashem. So how can Mordechai and Esther fix this? Or how do we see their response? So let's go back to the Megillah. We're on number 12. So Mordechai hears this decree, right? And we see how it's parallel, right, as a response to what happened, right, in Amalek earlier. So what is Mordechai's response? Mordechai yadat kol asher na'asa, vayikra, right, Mordechai bugadav, he tears his clothes, vayilbash sak va'efer, he wears sackcloth, vayitze betoch ha'ir, and he goes in the city, vayizak za'aka gedola umara, he cries out bitterly. And we can look at this two ways. Either he's wearing sackcloth, right, and he's crying out to Hashem, right, in the deepest way to undo your identity and crying out to Hashem as tefillah, or we can also see it as what? When do you tear your clothes? When do you wear sak va'efer? When do you cry out? When you're in mourning, in avelut. Which means there are two ways to look at this. Is this like the beginning of a new identity to cry out to Hashem to change the destiny of the Jewish people? Or is he already thinking what? This is the end. Which means I'm already in mourning for Am Yisrael. What do we know? Bechia, crying out, could be two different things. When we see with Hagar, right, what does she do when there's no more water? She throws him under one of the bushes, as far as you could shoot an arrow. And what is she, and she sits far and cries, and she says, so what is she really assuming or expecting? That he's going to die. And then it says, which means, whose tefillah does a Kodesh Baruch Hu hear? The tefillah of Ishmael. Because when she's crying, pretty much, what is she crying? In Avelut, it's finished. It's done. Which means, here we could see it in two ways. Is he doing Avelut and it's done? Look at the response of Am Yisrael. Midina o midina, makom asher dvar ha-melech v'dato magia. Every place where people hear the edict of Haman and the king. Evel gadol la'yudim. It's almost identical, but look at the more emphasis. Evel gadol la'yudim. Tzom ubechi umisped. Sak va'efer yutzal arabim. In the response of Bnei Israel, they're mimicking Mordechai, but what are they going one step further? What's the clear implication in the pasuk? Avelut and misped. Usually, when do you do misped? After someone's dead. Right? Now, we do have psukim in Yoel in Haftarat Shabbat Shuvah, and also in Yishayahu, the Haftarah that we read on Tzom, that you could use, on Yom Kippur, excuse me, you could use this language and say this is the ultimate level of teshuvah. But you could look at this language and also say, what is it? It's already avelut. Which means Am Yisrael feels, right, that there is no recourse. They're crying out to Hashem, but what are they already feeling? The end is near. Look at number 13. Where do we have this language of Vayizak Zaka Gdola Umara? We already saw it earlier with Shmuel, right? Where he's crying out because of what Shaul didn't do with Amalek. But we also have another Zaka, because again, what are we looking for? What kind of parallel? The parallel of what? Yaakov and Esav. Esav, Amalek. Amalek, Haman. Haman, Mordechai. So what do we see in number 13, which is in Breshit Kav Zayin, after Yitzchak gives the bracha to Yaakov, who comes in? Esav comes in. And what does he say? Ani b'chorcha Esav, but I am your b'chor. And what happens to Yitzchak? V'yecharad Yitzchak charada gdola. Right? Oh my gosh. Right? And what does he say? So who came before? But he came, gam baruch yeh. Even though he says, who came before that he realized it's Yaakov, he still says he could keep his bracha. But what happens when Esav hears this? Right? Vayitzak tzaaka gdola umara ad ma'od. Which means, just like Esav gave a tzaaka, right? Which means, what happens later on? Again, we know the Ramban talks about maaseh avot siman al banim. Whatever you do in one sefer in Tanakh, or one time in Jewish history, has an effect where? Later on. Which means, because Esav gave a tzaaka, now Mordechai is giving a tzaaka. So in a sense, what do we see here? Almost an equal balance. We have Bnei Israel trying to destroy Amalek, but they didn't do the right thing. We have Esav crying out. We have Haman trying to destroy Am Yisrael. And we have Mordechai crying out. So what do we have almost here? A stalemate. Almost like a spiritual stalemate. Which means we have these two forces on one side, on the Amalek side, and we have these two forces on the Mordechai, Am Yisrael side. So what do we need in the Megillah right now? What do we need, right? Kind of to see if we have something that will really tip the scales, right, at least in Am Yisrael's favor, right, in this cosmic battle, in a sense. So what do we see in number 14? Usually when you deal with Esav, right, this kind of enemy, right, what are the three things that Yaakov brings to Esav? Right? The famous Midrash, Rashi brings it, right? And the Pshat says it, right? Because what does Yaakov do? He splits his camp, he gives presents to Esav, and he davens to Hashem. So what happens, right? We see in Rashi, what are the three things you need? Number 14, Doron, you need a present. Tfilah and Milchama. Now, with Mordechai, when he is davening to Hashem, he's crying out to Hashem, so at least we have Tfilah. But what are we missing? Doron, right? And we're missing Milchama so far. Where do we see that Bnei Israel used Tfilah and Milchama against Amalek? What was their first confrontation? Look at number 15 in Shmot Yud Zayin. What's the first confrontation between Bnei Israel and Amalek? Right? They come out of Mitzrayim. Right? Kriyat Yamsuf. They're traveling. And they meet Amalek. And what are the two tools that they use versus Amalek? Yoshua. What's Yoshua's job? Yoshua fights. And what does Moshe do? He holds his hands up and he davened. So using those two elements, what are they able to do? Look at Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayachalosh Yoshuat Amalek v'tamol l'fichariv. Those two elements can do what? Can weaken Amalek, but not destroy them completely. Because what do we see the three things you always need when you go for Amalek? The three things. You need Tfilah, Doron, and Milchama. So in a sense, what do we know we will need, right, to destroy Amalek? You really will need all three things. To destroy Haman, somehow you'll need all three things together. Somehow we're going to need to unify all these three things. So let's see if that happens in the Megillah, and what is Mordechai's plan? So let's look at number 16, right? We're in Pasuk Chet, right? Now Mordechai, after he is davening, he's wearing sakva efer, right? But he feels that this is the end, right? So what does he need? Whose energy, whose activities does he need to harness? Esther, which means he's seeing his actions really are not solving this problem, right? So he calls on Esther. And what does he say to Esther? Look at number 16, Pasuk Chet. We're back to the Megillah. He tells her, right, and he commands her, Litzavot Alea. He says, you have to come to the king, Lavola Melech, and you have to beg him, right, to save Am Yisrael. So what does Mordechai think will work? Their davening to Hashem really didn't work yet in this case, right? So what does he ask Esther to do? She should really beg Ahasuerus to save Am Yisrael. And what does she respond? How come she can't just go to the king? Because what do you always need? You need to be invited, right? And I wasn't invited for 30 days, so I can't just come and greet the king. And what did you tell me my whole time here in the palace? Don't talk, don't make waves, right? Don't be forward. And now you're telling me to do a 180, right? And to really come forward to the king and to beg him? So what does Mordechai answer? Look at Pasuk Yud Gimel. He says to her, "Al tedami benafshech lihimalet bet hamelech mikol hayudim." Don't think you can save your life by hiding in the palace. Why would that be such a stinging response to Esther? Who in the past, from Esther's lineage, right, hid in the palace while David was out with the people? Michal bat Shaul. Look at number 17. Right, when David HaMelech was bringing the Aron Brit Hashem to Yerushalayim, where was Michal bat Shaul? She's at the window of the palace looking out, and she is vatives lo beliba. She is despising David in her heart, right? Who in the Megillah is described as despising a certain person? Haman, right, is despising Mordechai, but it's not worth it for him just to kill Mordechai. So who is he going to kill? The entire Jewish people, which means the fact that he is invoking this language and this, you know, description is saying, okay, Esther, right, are you going to go to the fallback position of your family? Are you going to be like Michal, who's hiding in the palace, sees herself separate from all Am Yisrael? Or are you going to be in the palace and see that you're part of all Am Yisrael and you're going to make a difference for everyone? Because what does he say? We're now on page 3, the next page, number 18. He says, "Ki ima charesh tacharishi." If you're quiet at this moment, and what do we know? It says about Shaul HaMelech, "Vayhi ki macharish." He was quiet. When people said things about him, he made as if he didn't hear. Which means sometimes being quiet is good. You are tsnua, right? And sometimes you have to really get out of that. You have to step forward and make a plan, because he tells her, "Revach v'hatzala yamod la'yudim imakom acher." What's going to happen? Bnei Yisrael are going to be saved in another way. Because what does Hashem always do? Hashem always saves Bnei Israel. But what do we need to do? We want to be the agents of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's telling her, you have to be the agent for the Hatzalah of Am Yisrael. Right? And if not, V'atu Beit Avich Tovedu. You and Shaul HaMelech's family and the name are going to totally be erased from the books of history, in a sense. You will only be remembered that you did not destroy Amalek. You have a chance now to rewrite history. You have a chance to redeem the family name. And he says, "Umi yodea im la'et kazot higat la'malchut." Maybe you came to this point of Malchut for this reason, which means Shaul came to Malchut to destroy Amalek. He doesn't do it. You are now Esther HaMalka. You have a chance to destroy Amalek. You have all the right, you know, history, genetics in a sense, right, personality, in order that you could do it. And what does Esther do? And now we see a switch. Vatomer Esther, right, lahashiv l'mordechai. Now Esther is setting the tone. And she says, number one, lech konoset kol ha'yudim. You have to gather all the Jews together. There has to be some kind of unity. What was disappointing to us, right, with Mordechai? Mordechai, we see avelut, and we see umedina, umedina. It's in every single state separate. Esther says, before we do anything, there has to be unity. Because what's a symbol of galut? Being separate, right? And what did Haman say about Bnei Israel? Yesh no'am echad mefozar o meforad ben kol ha'amim. When you are not unified, when Bnei Israel are in all the Medinot and they're separated, they have no koach. So number one, she says, you have to get everyone together. Lech knoset kol ha'yudim. Everyone has to be together. And not only that, vetsumu alai. You have to fast. which means in this whole book, we talk about food, we talk about parties, how do you use food, and we have something very interesting with Shaul HaMelech, right? Just a perek earlier, before he destroys Amalek, or tries to destroy Amalek, they're in battle, and he says everyone should fast. And what does his son do in the middle of the battle? He takes a stick and he dips it in the honey. And he dips it in the honey, he eats it, and he feels revived. And he said, you know, if every one of the soldiers ate, then they would be able to fight better, which means there's a time for fast, and there's a time for fighting. There's a time for eating and partying, and there's a time for being serious, which means it's not that we reject happiness. It's not that we reject food. It's not that we reject materialism, but everything has to be balanced in the right way. So she is saying, you have to fast for me. And not only that, and she says, V'kasher avadati avadati. I'm willing to take the responsibility, right? And I'm willing to take the consequences. And what happens? Vayavor Mordechai vayas kechol asher tzivta alav Esther. Now who's setting the tone? It's Esther. So here we have the transition from passive to she is now deciding, right? After she realizes that she has this responsibility, she now makes the plan that's going to save Am Yisrael. And what is her plan? Her plan is to make two parties. And why are these two parties important? Because what is the way to defeat Amalek? What are they into? Power, kavod, money. By her inviting just Haman and Ahasuerus to the party, what is she pretty much sowing? Seeds of jealousy. Ahasuerus is wondering why only Haman is invited, and Haman is wondering, wow, why is Esther only inviting me and Ahasuerus? Now maybe I have more power than originally. And what happens in the middle of the night, right? Ahasuerus can't sleep. He finds out how Mordechai helped him. He wants to pay back Mordechai. And who happens to be in the palace in the middle of the night? Haman. Why is Haman there? Because he wants to get permission to build a gallows for Mordechai, right? But look what an amazing coincidence. Ahasuerus just sees that Haman is in the palace. We don't get him to say that he's there in order to hang Mordechai. We only see that he's in the palace. Ahasuerus is thinking, what's he doing in the palace? To make things worse, right, when he asks him, what should I do for a person that I care about, that I want to honor, what does Haman tell him? Give him the king's horse. Give him the king's clothes. Give him the king's crown. Given the king's scepter. And the person should cry out, this is what the king wants to do for a person that he respects. Right? So what does that show? What is Haman pretty much saying? I want to be king. So what is Ahasuerus thinking? He's already threatened by this. Number two, what does Esther say in the party? Esther says in the party, right? Esther says in the party, as we said earlier, right? What isn't it clear? Right? It's not clear, right, that Ahasuerus knows what Haman's plan is, right? We only know that he wants to la'abed et ha'yudim, and he wants to get money for it. At the party, what does Esther say very clearly Haman's plan is? To kill and destroy all the Jews. So now, Ahasuerus is betrayed on two levels. Number one, what is he betrayed? He's betrayed that Haman, right, who he trusted so much, now already he's a little suspicious about Haman, right? What does he want, right? Does he want my kingdom? Does he want my queen? And number two, we see that Ahasuerus realizes, I trusted Haman completely, and now he wants to destroy, right, my queen's group, my queen's nation. He wants to, right, destroy them and kill them completely. I didn't get that clearly that that was his plan. This person is not trustworthy, not on a national level and not on a personal level. And as a result, what does Ahasuerus want to do? He orders that Haman should be killed right away. Now, why does Esther want to kill Haman? Why didn't she just do what Mordechai told her to throw herself and beg Ahasuerus to save Bnei Israel? Why? What tikkun?
That he didn't kill Agag.
That he didn't kill Agag, which means Esther wants to make sure that Haman will be destroyed. Haman is an Agagi. She wants to make sure that Haman is going to be destroyed. That's her first on her agenda. That's why it's Megillat Esther, even though Mordechai is so central. Because she is the one, right, that makes sure, right, to redeem the family name and to destroy Amalek. After that, what does she realize? I have another goal. What's my other goal? To save all of Am Yisrael. And how does she save all of Am Yisrael? Look at number 21, right? She then, Pasuk Gimel, Vatosef Esther, Vatedaber Lifnei Amelech, Vatipol Lifnei Raglav, Vatef Vatitchanen Lo. Meaning, what does she do? Now what does she do? She begs Ahasuerus. First, she wanted to destroy Haman. Mordechai just wanted to save all the Jews. She wants to make sure that also Haman is going to be destroyed. And in the end, what do the Jews do? They can't rescind the decree. So they send out a new decree. And what's the new decree? Right? Look at number 22. Esther Perek Chet Pasuk Yud Aleph. The decree that the Jews get is that they can lahashmid, laharog, laabed, et kol chel amum dina, tsarim otam, taf, venashim, ushlalam lavoz. What are they able to do? They are able to destroy everybody, right? Women and children, and also what could the Jews do? Take the shalal. Now, what would be another important tikkun, right? We did Agag, we did Haman. What's another very important tikkun here? What does Esther, Bnei Israel, have to do? Not take the money, right? And they have to just do self-defense. And they can't kill the women and children. Because what aren't all these people? They're not Amalek, right? So in order for it to be a just war, right, Bnei Israel can only do self-defense. So what does it say? Look at Pasuk Tetzayin. Ve'amod al nafsham. They defended themselves. If you look at Pasuk Tetvav, it says they only killed in Shushan 300 ish, only 300 males, which means people that are really, let's say, could be a real threat and they were just doing self-defense. And in Tetvav and Tetzayin, it says ubabiza lo shalchu et yadam twice in Shushan and in all the cities. What does the Megillah tell us very clearly? What didn't they take? They didn't take the shalal. It is so important that the Megillah says that, because then we see it's really a tikkun. And how do we celebrate Purim? On two levels, right? When Bnei Israel were saved, they made a mishteh v'simcha. Why? Because we want to show that you could do mishteh v'simcha in the right way. Mishteh v'simcha is not always negative. It's not always like the mishteh v'chashverosh, right? You can do a good mishteh v'simcha. Also, we give, right? Mishloach manot ish l're'eu u'matanot l'evyonim. Why is that? Because what did we say the whole story starts with? Galut, right? The ger yatom and almana, the idea of being powerless, right? Disenfranchised. What does matanot le'evyonim symbolize? Caring about the poor, which means caring about the community. What does mishloach manot symbolize? You care about the community, even your friends, which means we have power in knoset kol ayudim, unity, caring about your friends, caring about the disenfranchised. And also we can do it through mishteh v'simcha. But if you look at Pasuk Lamed Aleph, or number 24, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, the way it's described is to remember divrei hatzomot v'zakatam. Usually I would think about Esther as parties, not divrei hatzomot v'zakatam. Why do we remember the fasting, right? Why do we remember the fasting? Because it's the idea of tzom, right? That's what led to the mishteh v'simcha. And how do we celebrate Purim? We fast. Usually not this year. Usually what do? Right? We are already still fasting when we read the Megillah the first time at night. Which means the tzom can only lead to Kriyat HaMegillah and to the simcha or mishteh. Which means you need both. So the whole process of Purim is about realizing the tzom that leads to the mishteh v'simcha. And also we see that it constantly says, right, in 24, Esther Perek Tet Pasuk Zayin, Kimu v'kiblu hayu Yehudim alehem. Right, this is what Bnei Israel accepted upon themselves. And constantly we have the shorish, lekayem, 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 kimu v'kiblu, kiyam alehem Mordechai, which means Bnei Israel accepted the Torah, right? And we have the famous midrash that Bnei Israel totally accepted the Torah by their own free will. Why? Because Purim was a time that everything was in the balance, and they realized the idea of Hashkacha, the idea of Dvar Hashem, and we see this bigger tikkun that Mordechai and Esther, but especially Esther, was able to do. So even though we begin the story with Mordechai, and we say out the three psukim about Mordechai, and we end the Megillah with Mordechai, what is it called? Megillat Esther. And what is the Ta'anit called? Ta'anit Esther, because she's the one that instituted it. Which means she is really the main heroine of this story. And again, going back to the original idea that we started with, she is the one, we don't know what her personality is. We don't know. We know she's quiet, nua, but it doesn't tell us, right, that she had a certain personality. She looked a certain way. She was this kind of individual, which means it's really telling us everyone, every single individual, every woman has this capacity with whatever her strength is to really develop that and to really bring Geula la'olam, which means Esther really represents for us, right, the idea of Bizchut Nashim Tzidkaniyot. And that's why we have Simchat Purim. And that's why women are obligated in every single one of the mitzvot of Purim, because afhen ayu bo toanes, because we were ikar hanes. So we should really celebrate Purim and realize that Adar and Nisan are really the chodashim of the Yeshua of the Nashim, which means the koach, the ability, right, to take whatever it is, to turn it around slowly but surely, by unity, by chesed, by a certain kind of inner strength, is really what Purim is telling us specifically. So for Chodesh Adar, right, Mishinichnas Adar Marbim Simcha, Simcha could be used in a very positive way. And we really have this ability, right, to initiate not just Simcha that is just for one generation, as we see, right, Vizichram lo yasuf mizaram. All our actions, right, can really have almost an eternal impact. So Chodesh Tov.